FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500.
In this special edition of Straight Talk Africa, 11 years after South Sudan gained its independence, we'll take stock of what this country has accomplished for its people. Has the promise of a new dawn been realized? And what lies ahead for Africa's youngest nation? We'll bring you in-depth reporting from our team in the capital, Juba, and expert analysis. We'll also hear from South Sudanese people at home and abroad about what they want for the future of their country.
I think involving the youth is a very, very important part of the solution. We appreciate what the previous generation has done, but at some point you have to pass on the torch to the next generation.
South Sudan, the road to democracy. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. On July 9th, 2011, the people of South Sudan erupted in celebration as that country became an independent nation. After a decades-long struggle for statehood and self-determination, South Sudan finally seceded from Sudan. And for this young nation, as for any country that's had to fight for its independence, the road to democracy has been neither straight nor smooth. In the next hour, our reporting team will take you inside South Sudan for a closer look at the progress made, the problems that persist, and more importantly, the critical path forward. John Tanzer is the managing editor of VOA's South Sudan in Focus radio program. He's in his home country, and we begin our coverage there with John on the streets of Juba.
With the Independence Day plans dampened, many South Sudanese in the country and worldwide are now looking forward to 2023 elections. However, the slow implementation of the 2018 peace agreement has many concerned that it will never happen. So far, parties to the agreement have only implemented two chapters addressing power sharing and constitutional review process, but six chapters remain unfulfilled. The question for many is why? Kwaje Lasso is the chairman of the South Sudan National Movement for Change, a rebel group that refused to sign the 2018 peace deal.
I was very involved in this process of bringing change. I sit in front of you here today as member of the negotiation in that brought the RRPs. However, some of us realize that agreement has a lot of loopholes that need to be addressed. In fact, that the agreement failed to address the fundamental root causes of the crisis.
Lack of democratic space within the then ruling SPLM party, poor governance system, corruption, nepotism, and tribalism were some of the drivers of South Sudan's political crisis. Some South Sudanese representing various groups that signed the peace agreement have different opinions on the slow implementation of the deal. Ambassador John Guy, a member of parliament from President Salva Kiir's Sudan People's Liberation Movement, says it is up to the leaders of the country to chart the way forward.
I think the debate should start now. If the agreement is coming to an end, say in 7 or 8 months, are we going for elections? If so, how? What are we going to do? And what are the checklists? If we are not going to election, then are we going for a new debate as to whether this agreement is useful or we are going to throw it away and come with a new agreement?
Many South Sudanese worry about what will emerge after the end of the transitional period in February 2023. Among the issues preoccupying citizens are the tough economic environment, skyrocketing prices, and unreliable sources of income.
The way forward is to implement the revitalized peace agreement. If they implement, the rest of the thing will follow. And if later on there is free and fair election, that's what I'm yearning for. The future for this country is rule of law. If we don't have rule of law, we are finished.
We have to really think hard or be realistic also that are we ready, psychologically ready, prepared to vote? And also, is the ground prepared, is leveled for everybody to come out and also do these things? These are demands established by democracies all over the world.
A high time that they should go to various villages and ask them, what do you think of us? What do you think we have gone wrong? And what do you think can actually build peace among the different community?
Youth, who comprise the majority of South Sudan's population, say they live in fear due to restricted political space, lack of press freedom, frequent harassment by security operatives, and increased violence around the country. An incident like the deadly violence in Warab State that left 30 people dead serves as an example. Speaking from the diaspora and looking on, youth say it's time for country's leaders to make way for them.
Involving the youth is a very, very important part of the solution, because at the end of the day, we appreciate what the previous generation has done. But at some point, you have to pass on the torch to the next generation.
As the country forges ahead with plans to hold elections next year, not everybody believes the country is ready for democratic transition. Malakal Gok is a member of the SPLM-IO faction, loyal to General Simon Gatwich.
So
he says the country is not ready for elections.
From calling for election, rather leading focus on implementing the security arrangements, bring all the oppositions back to the country, and then give them a freedom of political democratization system where everybody will also contest freely.
Despite that sentiment, President Kiir's SPLM party is mobilizing its members for elections, saying the country is on the right track. Lado Artema is the Secretary General of the SPLM office in the United States.
We establish a nation, and we have to have that window to dialogue among ourselves. Even if you disagree with the government, you have to have also create for yourself that space to speak out to the government and present your problems so that the government can actually respond and address them. If you don't have that window of communication and you run out and defect and form a rebel movement, then there's no dialogue.
With the 2023 elections questionable due to unfulfilled peace agreement, and Independence Day stripped off of its celebratory atmosphere due to poor economy, South Sudanese are calling on the government to ensure peace and security in the country and to provide basic services. John Tanza, VOA News, Juba, South Sudan.
And that was excellent reporting there from our team in Juba, John Tanza, Karina Chowdhury and Andrew Wani. Thank you. So we asked South Sudanese people at home and in the diaspora whether they think their country is ready to hold national elections.
Their forces has not been unified up to now, because whenever there is election, the security must be tight, because people will be free to move during the election. The security is not up to date some areas. So these are the questions that we ask ourselves, that how far the government has gone with that one. But for direction, we are willing for direction. We are ready for direction at any time.
The peace agreement, the time that is taking, it's slow. And also the fact that we are just coming out of war, and people are hoping that the government will finally sit down and make a coalition government that will move towards election and into a democratic process that will bring solutions to the current situation.
What is happening about the coming elections is that we are putting everything in God's plans. God will decide if I will be alive during elections to vote or not. If I am alive, why will I not vote? Life is tough here. The prices in the markets are high.
We need the election to be there, because when there is the election, there will be some good changes. But our main fear is, up to now, there is a great insecurity in the whole country. Before the election, people go for census. because the census needs to register everybody in the country. But if there is a lot of insecurity, it will be even difficult for those who will conduct the census to go all every parts of the country. So this is our main fear.
Now, 11 years after independence, what's been accomplished for the people of South Sudan? What hasn't? And what lies ahead for Africa's youngest nation? Well, earlier, John Tanza sat down with political leaders and analysts in the South Sudanese capital, Juba, to discuss South Sudan's road to democracy.
I am here in South Sudan's capital, Juba, with three distinguished guests who are going to be taking part in this special edition of Straight Talk Africa. But before we get into our discussion, I would just like to bring to our listeners the context and the background of what has been happening in South Sudan since the country got its independence. 11 years down the lane, South Sudan experienced two bitter street battles fought here in the capital, Juba, between the South Sudan People's Defense Force and troops loyal to former rebels of the SPLA-IO under the chairmanship of Dr. Riek Machar. One agreement was signed in 2018. Its implementation is still going on. Some analysts say the parties and the signatories to the agreement implemented it selectively. That is, they took Chapter 1, which is on power sharing and responsibility sharing, and then Chapter 6, which is on constitutional review process. The other six chapters have not been implemented. And a lot of South Sudanese who spoke to us here in Juba say they are casting doubt that the transitional government will complete the other six chapters before 2023, which is the end of the transitional period. With me here in our studio in Juba here, on my right is Honorable Stephen Parr, Minister for Peace Building, and the lady in the middle is Lona Merekaje, an activist who has been advocating for peace for like 8 to 9 years. And on our far right is Honorable Michael Makwe, the Minister for Information and Postal Services, and at the same time, the government spokesperson. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this special edition of Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Before we get into the hot issues, I would want to start with you, Mr. Minister. The country got its independence 11 years ago, and your government has been, you know, struggling to bring everybody on board so that you can silence the guns. Could you give us a scorecard on that?
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity. In fact, the government of South Sudan, of course, with independence in 2011, was established. And before we could put our house in order, there erupted the crisis of 2013. Crisis of 2013 put us, was a real setback to us in the government. And not only in the government, but to the people of South Sudan as such. So we continued, and we started negotiations immediately in December the same year, and we signed the cessation of hostilities. That was followed by a series of negotiations which culminated into the signing of the agreement, the last agreement. Let me cut off all the other agreements, but the last agreement was signed in 2018. This is the agreement which is now operational, and this is the agreement that the government, the transitional government of national unity, is implementing. And this is where we are. So far, yes, we have not achieved all that is provided for in the agreement because of other hurdles. We have ever been saying that this agreement was not actually meant to be fully implemented. Otherwise, the time frame which was allocated for that is not sufficient and not possible to really implement the agreement as it is. But nevertheless, the government had been trying its level best to implement the agreement. And so far, we have almost finished Chapter 1. And Chapter 1 is only about what is left in Chapter 1 is the issue of the commissions and institutions. And most of these are connected with enactment of laws, which have not yet been enacted, or amendment of laws which are not yet amended. So there is no way we can proceed without. Chapter 2, yes, this is where we have difficulty, really. And in Chapter 2, we have difficulty in terms of implementation because of so many problems. Chapter 2 is the most expensive.
Because it involves the unified forces,
security arrangements, security mechanisms. That is what I refer to.
Why is it expensive?
It is expensive because it has so many requirements. It has so many requirements and so many proceedings to be conducted. However, despite all these difficulties, of course, one of them is the finances. We don't have the necessary required resources for funding this process. Yes, we have forces in the field undergoing training. These forces are supposed to be graduated, but up to now we are unable to graduate them simply because of two things. One, for you to graduate forces, you must have these forces full in combat uniform. They must be armed and they must have uniform. The arms embargo, which has been imposed on us by the international community, has made it impossible for us to acquire all these. We don't manufacture them here, but it has made it impossible for us to acquire all these.
We'll come back to the other issues going down the line. Let's give a chance to Minister Stephen Parr, who is representing the SPLM-IO. Honorable Makwe raised crucial issues here. One, he said the agreement was not meant to be implemented. Very difficult agreement. And the government and the other partners are trying their best to implement it. He touched on Chapter 2, which I was going to ask you about. There are troops that are still in cantonment areas, and the minister is saying there are two issues, money and secondly, the arms embargo. Do you subscribe to his conclusions?
Well, overall, I agree with Honorable Michael that the agreement is a huge operation. The implementation of the agreement is costly. In need time, but I disagree respectfully with the idea that the agreement was not signed to be implemented.
No, it was not meant to be implemented, he said.
It was meant to be implemented. The agreement was meant to be implemented. It was signed to be implemented. And it has to be implemented by Artigono. Another thing I want to correct here is that I and Honorable Makwe are members of Artigono. We don't necessarily represent our parties to some extent. We chaired one.
But you are in the government on the ticket of the SPLM.
Well, in the government,
SPLM-IO.
In the government, we have a common responsibility as one government to implement the agreement. So the agreement must be implemented because the government of the day, the Artigono, was established by this agreement, and the mandate of this agreement, according to Chapter 1 of this agreement. The mandate of this government is to implement the agreement. This government is a government of peace agreement to implement the peace agreement. Our mandate is that. Our prime mandate is for us to bring peace to South Sudan. So the agreement must be implemented. If we don't implement the agreement, then we will all suffer from the legitimacy crisis. It is this agreement that legitimizes us. It is this agreement that put us in one government to bring peace to the people of South Sudan. So the agreement was meant to be implemented, and it has to be implemented in letter and spirit. Yes, I agree with him. It cost
a lot to implement it, especially Chapter 2. I also doubled as the Secretary General of the NTC, which is composed of ministers. It is a ministerial committee to implement Chapter 2, especially the transitional security arrangement.
And how far are you with the preparations for the graduation of the unified forces? Because this is, we spoke to people around the country and they're saying, when you talk about elections and there are no unified forces on the ground, who is going to provide security? So how far are you with that process? I will want you to be brief so that we give Lon an opportunity to also add.
Overall, the only progress we have made is to, we have made the following progresses, and you must also acknowledge them. We have maintained this permanent ceasefire, because transitional security arrangement is not only the graduation of forces. It was cantonment of forces, assembling of forces, barracking of forces, unifying the forces, training them together. We have accomplished this in our training centers. We are left only with the graduation of forces. Graduation of forces is not also an end in itself. It is graduating them, deploying them. This is, as Honorable Michael put it correctly, it is a huge operation which is very costly. South Sudan cannot do it alone. We have been approaching the international community to also come in to support us.
Yeah, I know that you guys, the partners to the peace agreement, have spoken several times saying the international community must come in to help. Let me give an opportunity to Lona. I will come back to you. Let me give an opportunity to Lona to hear from her. What is the civil society seeing that everybody is not seeing? Some of you have been part and parcel of the implementation process.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Tanza. I want to say that in 2018, the agreement was received with a lot of hope, trusting that what was signed is to be implemented. And I want to reiterate that until today, we still see that what has been signed could be implemented and can be implemented. So
what is preventing it from being implemented?
Thank you very much. Coming to what the civil society see is that we see intermittent implementation of the agreement. And that boils down to what we refer to deficiency of political will among the political actors, regardless of particular party. So to us as civil society, we feel that those that constitute the current Archigonu do not have the will to implement the agreement. Perhaps they are comfortable and they do not see what is going on outside of the confines of their comfort zone.
Both of them are laughing.
Yes.
That means you have touched their heart.
That's basically what the political will.
I see the government meeting, committees are busy, and there's some activities going on.
Yes, it
in
is.
In terms of the partners trying their best to make sure that they implement all the 8 chapters. What do you mean when you say there's no political will?
It's puzzling. You know, the agreement in itself, and I think this is a problem that faces South Sudan in all spheres of governance in this country, and I have said this repeatedly, that one of the problems we have is we have complex documents as the agreement, but when we come home, we don't develop legs to anchor the documents. The legs to anchor the documents are operationalization equipment, instruments. We needed to have different instruments to operationalize the agreement. That has not sufficiently happened.
You are a member of the constitutional making process, or
Constitution Amendment Committee, and at the same time, I'm a member of the Public Finance Management Oversight Committee.
What progress have you done? Give us a score sheet.
From our side, one of the things that we have done, and I always say that the drafters of the agreement needed to sit where we are sitting, is that within 21 days we were able to incorporate the agreement into the Constitution and come up with Amendment number 6, which incorporates the agreement into the Constitution. After that, we looked at the security laws within the prescribed time frame. we were able to complete the review of the security law from our side. Where did it get stuck? At the executive.
Honorable Michael Makuei, the ball is in your court that you, the executive, have sat on what the other committees have passed on to you. Could you comment on her conclusion that there's no political will to move forward?
You see, it is unfortunate, with due respect to her opinion. Who is that person who has the yardstick for measuring the level of commitment? This is the point. I have been hearing so many people, and especially the civil society, that the government does not have the will. What is their yardstick for measuring the commitment, the level of commitment of the government? To me, I say we are fully committed. And this is why we are here now. We have reached here so far. I said this agreement was not to be implemented, as I said it earlier, because the international community, the very international community that supported us and gave us the assurances that you sign this agreement, we will stand with you and we will implement it with you. Just immediately after signature, they sat back and began to tell us, you implement. You must be seen to be moving. We asked them, as said by my colleague, Stephen, we asked them to come for our support. Only very few friendly countries managed to do something for us. But up to now, even, some of them are not signatories to the agreement. They have not signed the agreement. And they come and talk to us that you must implement the agreement. Not that only, but in order to obstruct us more, and to tell us that this agreement, we do not mean it to be implemented, is the arms embargo. Yeah? Once they went in for the arms embargo, to make it difficult for us to graduate the forces. Because if a force is not a force if it doesn't have if you don't have a gun, a rifle to give to a soldier, he is not a soldier. We don't have the guns.
But these forces, sorry to cut you short, Mr. Minister, these forces belonged to various warring groups. They were not fighting the government with sticks. They had their guns with them. So when they were taken to cantonment sites, where did they leave their guns?
Well, you are right in that. But we did not come here to blame the FARC. But we need to look forward and see how best we can move forward from here. Yes, a mistake was committed when these forces were taken to the training centers. The mistake was that these forces, instead of they handing over their guns, especially the opposition forces, for the government forces, for SSPDF, their forces are in their barracks.
Their guns are in the barracks.
Their guns are. But the problem is these forces who were in the opposition that came and were taken for training. These are the forces that have no guns because of a mistake which happened in the past. Now, for us to graduate these forces, we must get arms for them. And the international community here tells us that you graduate these forces. And when we say, okay, lift the arms embargo so that a good Samaritan can give us arms to graduate these forces, and they say no.
Minister,
then what is their intention?
Where did you leave your guns, the I.O.?
Let me correct one thing. And this is a policy that has been going on for a very long time. That the reason why we are not graduating the forces is a lack of weapon. This is not serious. The I.O. weapons are in the cantonment. And for your information, John, the uniform that SPLA I.O. forces wear is the same uniform that
the South Sudan People's Defense Force wear.
Also wear. The AK-47, which is especially the weapons of the, what you call organic weapon of the forces, are there. But there was a rule that when you get to the cantonment, you are disarmed. You leave your weapon here. Even the government is not supposed to come to the training centers with weapon. Web training everywhere in the world is done with a stick until the time of graduation. If we need weapon today to equip those forces in the training centers, lack of weapons will not be the obstacle, practically speaking. If we had weapon for fighting ourselves, why shouldn't we have also weapons for graduating our forces today? In fact, the truth on the ground, John, is that there is no lack of weapon in South Sudan. Actually, we have surplus of them. The abundance of the weapon in South Sudan is also the problem to the stability of our country. We can get the weapons today, especially the organic weapon of the force to graduate them. About arm embargo, another thing, that is a different issue altogether. What we are blaming the international community for is that even where they are now in the training centers, our forces do not have the human, you know, the necessities for human life, medicine, shelters, food. This has been a problem. The size of our economy and with the impacts of the COVID-19 and the economic crisis all over the world, as you can see it. We are a young economy here. If the international community is serious about bringing peace to South Sudan, South Sudan need financial aid now. And not only financial aid to process, because graduation is an event.
Yes.
But the process of transitional security arrangement is a tall order.
Yes, you said that
before. The bulk of the fighting force of the SPLA-IO is still in the cantonment.
Yeah. Let's get to the details of what is happening at the cantonment side and what has not been done. Let me give an opportunity to Lorna here to react. Lorna, you've heard from the two members of the executive here. Minister Makuei is saying it is the arms embargo that is preventing the graduation of the unified forces. Minister Stephen is saying, no, there are arms. He doesn't believe that is the arms embargo. That is, what do you see, the civil society? What do you people see? I mean, how do you see the implications of these statements for the peace agreement to move forward?
I think, you know, going back to what there's this question about quantifying political will, quantifying commitment, and Honorable today put it in a very nice way, the yardstick for commitment. We can clearly see from the same house, this is what civil society see, from the same structure, there's different perception of why not move forward. I think to us that is discouraging, because to us that shows that there is no shared vision of where the current Artigon wants to take the country. Because if you see what Honorable Minister have said, we look at it differently. The arms embargo was imposed because of a reason. There are ways through which we can be able to negotiate the country out of the arms embargo. There are deliverables.
Can you
implement
tell us about
the agreement?
How they can come out
implement
of the arms embargo.
The agreement. Let's not stick and say that because we don't have equipment to graduate the forces. Let's use the existing equipment that on my left, one of the executive is saying. That equates, that balances the equation. Number two is that South Sudan is a country that is producing oil. Where does our money go? And the civil society, we asked this question and our colleague was locked up and people feel a bit coy to ask the question. But the question is, when Gurushia Jama? The South Sudan oil is being explored. We know that at the moment, even the transitional financial arrangement to Sudan, we have completed paying it. Still, we are not seeing money translating in the country.
And we'll bring you part two of that discussion after the break. This is a special edition of Straight Talk Africa, South Sudan, the road to democracy. Straight Talk Africa will be back in a moment. Stay with us.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back to our special edition of Straight Talk Africa. This week, our focus is South Sudan's road to democracy. Now, 11 years after it won independence from Sudan, South Sudan's economy reflects two very different realities. Those who are thriving, people who work in sectors like oil, real estate, or luxury goods and services. And then there are those stuck in relative poverty, which happens to be the majority of the country's citizens. VOA's John Tanza has more.
Custom Market in Juba Town is one of the oldest markets in South Sudan, and vendors from across Africa, including Uganda, Kenya, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan, and South Sudan, come here to tout all kind of products from their makeshift shops and escape the blazing sun. Here, you can find anything from food items, new and used clothes, phones, and car spare parts. Most of the local traders say, however, their profits are low because few South Sudanese can afford their prices.
The challenges that we are facing in our business, the price of everything have been increased in the market there, but we are still selling in the same price. Because if we increase our price, the customers will not buy the thing. We are facing a lot of challenges. One of the challenges are those of city council. They are coming to take from us, other, especially like money for garbage. Other, they said, are for trading licenses, which even we don't have.
For many small-scale vendors, business was good before the 2013 and 2016 political crisis, which they say dented the economy.
Before, we used to buy things cheaper, but now the prices have increased. From the wholesale, a shoe for 3,000 and a half has now increased to 4,800 Sudanese pounds. We don't get clients who can afford these prices.
But not all South Sudanese are experiencing hardships. For some, like Lawrence Korbandi, former legal advisor to President Salva Kiir, an investor in real estate and education, business is good.
Juba and other towns of South Sudan, you can invest in them, provide that you select your own choice as investor, be you local or national investor, or international investors.
Korbandi says investors and traders should look for new opportunities in the country. He says South Sudanese who have money are seeking for better services from investors.
In situations like ours, there are three types of investment. Investing in education, because every household would like that children to go to best schools. That is why some of us are sending their kids in neighboring countries. The other investment is the health. People never stop being sick in countries like ours. So if you invest in good hospitals, you will still make money. And the third one is the food commodity.
South Sudanese businessman Chol Lam, a senior partner at the local South Sudanese oil company, Chang Wei CW, also says he's doing well in the current economy.
The economy of South Sudan focuses on the crude sales. But in terms of the services, there's a huge revenue stream within the oil services. I would say equal to the oil that's being sold in terms of the crude. The oil services is dominated, I would say, by the Chinese. The majority in the oil sector, in the services. And the budget for oil services, I would assume it's something close to $1.5 to $2 billion annually.
Another sector that appears to be thriving despite the tough economic climate is interior design, like APA Interiors, the only one-stop interior design shop for locals and expatriates in Juba. Apajok Aler, who studied interior architecture in Italy, has found her niche in Juba, where she has introduced interior architecture to more clients.
Our business, it's going well. We have a lot of clients, and we can't complain. There was a missing gap, and we were that link that we needed to be in. There were a few challenges, obviously. Setting up a business from the start is always hard. And also making people understand the need for interior design.
Despite the tough economy, some South Sudanese are making ends meet any way they can, like this University of Juba student who operates a local motorbike taxi known as Border Border, which he says has enabled him to continue with his studies.
I'm currently upgrading to degree. So with no one to sponsor me, to support me, and with no proper job, that's when I decided to create for myself a business, at least to facilitate my studies and even support my family.
This Nigerian national has been importing his country's fabrics into South Sudan for 21 years and says the country offers business opportunities for both local and international investors and traders.
South Sudan, they need people to come here. So if you come here just for work, they are welcome with you. But if you come, you want to work to get money, it's good. There is no any challenges here in South Sudan.
According to the World Bank's latest South Sudan Economic Monitor, the improving microeconomic conditions and relative peace that have supported a rebound of growth in services and trade, South Sudan's economy is projected to grow by 1.2%.
And that is where we pick up our conversation with John and his guests in Juba.
I have lived in Juba for a week and a half, and I am feeling it because people call you, people tell you their problems, and even when you go to the markets, speak to traders, they say the prices of things are no longer what they used to be. And the common men and women are really struggling to put food on the table. Mr. Minister, this is within your docket. The government is, the people are looking to the government for a solution. And at the same time, they also think the government should really do something so that people can have food on the table. What is happening?
It is the duty of the government to make sure that there is food on every table, every South Sudanese table. And this is an overall policy by all the governments of the world. But here comes in the difference between the state, between the countries, as the case may be. There are some countries there that have sufficient resources and they are capable of rendering those services. And there are some countries that are grappling with other things. And as such, they cannot actually provide food on the table for the people, for its people. South Sudan is one of them. It's one of them because the problems that are heaped for South Sudan to resolve are so many. And our resources, even though the civil society is asking where our money is going, our money
is quite going, a legitimate question.
Our money. Even if you have the oil, it doesn't mean that that money of the oil is just open and it flows like that. Of course, the production has its own limitations. The market prices have their own limitations. Our world commitments, international commitments, they have our own implementations. Implementation of the agreement itself has its own implementations. And above all, implementation of the agreement with all the concerns where you have thousands of MPs at present. You have 650 MPs
members
at the national level.
National and state or talking
national,
about?
National level only. The State Council of States and the National Assembly, there are 650. There are 100
members in each state. And we have 10 states and 3 administrative areas. These are members of parliament alone. And then you go to the staff. So you find that, in fact, South Sudan is the country where there is real overemployment, overstaffing. And as such, we are overspending. So the whole budget, whatever comes from the oil, goes to these institutions for them to function.
But even these institutions have not been paid also for a long time. Civil servants have not received their salaries for a long time.
Don't say they have not received. They have been receiving.
When was the last
time? When was the last time? Yes. The last time was last week. We are in January,
we are in
July.
Arrears, Honorable. Hmm? We still have an issue of arrears.
Okay, yes, there are arrears. Mm-hmm. There are arrears, but we are paying. And
I've just been reminded that we have 10 minutes left, so I would want to make good use of that 10 minutes. I give you an opportunity, Minister Stephen Parr, to chart the way forward. Election is coming in 2023. I have seen your one partner from the agreement is warming up, mobilizing its members. That's the SPLM in government. They are warming up, mobilizing their members, saying, come rain, come sunshine, we must have elections.
Well,
give us your reading on how do you see the slow implementation impacting the democratic transition?
It will impact it big time because the agreement is very clear on what to do before the elections. In chapter 2, we are talking about security arrangements. You know that the cause of most of the turmoil in Africa happened after what you call post-election violence. You need to organize.
Are you predicting it in South Sudan?
I'm just telling you this one. You cannot take a country with two armies to the election. That's one thing. The other thing is there is a provision for drafting constitution, which will tell you what kind of government we are electing people to. There must also be a census done for us to draw out and map out our constituencies. The electoral law is also not reviewed and amended and assented into law yet by the president. So whoever is talking about election now is not in his right mind. I don't even think that the SPLM party meant elections.
But I've seen the Secretary General traveling from one state to another, calling on its members to turn out.
I think they are just organizing themselves. We are also organizing ourselves. But about elections, you need to look critically at the provision of the agreement. Governments are established by constitutions, not government establishing constitution. It is a permanent constitution which we are going to make. That will establish that system of government to which you elect officials.
Thank you. Lorna, these delays, the things that we have discussed here, the economy, the lack of political will, the unified forces still at cantonment sites, how is that going to impact the democratic transition? Because at the end of the transitional period, there has to be something done. How is this going to impact?
Thank you very much. It's definitely going to impact the transition.
How?
The desire of the people is that at least South Sudan should transit from this kind of arrangement into a normal governance system by 2023. But unfortunately, the way things are right now, it's not feasible to conduct elections 60 days before end of the transitional period. And I fear for my two fellow panelists that if nothing is done, the institutions that they head are going to lose legitimacy. And we are going to have a country that have a government. Yes, they can still go to their offices, but not legitimate. And I think this is a very difficult question for the country. It's important we start thinking of the way forward. Again, back to where I started from. We need to develop instruments for actualizing what we have planned. Right now, we are looking at constitution-making process. We are looking at elections coming. But if you look at the state of Electoral Commission right now, you will be out of this world to think that they will conduct election. And I want to come back to what Honorable Michael said earlier. Perhaps we need to, if we talk about help from the internationals, we need to define the kind of help. And I think election is an area where we might need to call for help from outside to be able to conduct a credible, free, fair election in
South
Sudan.
Thank you. Minister Michael Makuei, the people that we speak to are saying doing elections in an environment that is in South Sudan today is a recipe for disaster. They're saying security is a major concern. It's an open secret that chiefs of organized forces went to Tonj to quell down a situation there where some senior officers were shot. And this is just an example of other crises that are in the places. Is the government still set to move forward with this plan for elections after the transitional period?
Yes. In fact, when we say the government, I don't think that we are sitting here as government. I'm sitting here as SPLM, he is an IO, as you can see. But when we go and sit in the cabinet, we are the government.
You're one.
When we perform our functions and duties, we are one. But when we are expressing opinions, we are different. So I represent my party, and he represents his party. This is why he said we are organizing, preparing for the... And in fact, his chairman declared, it is in the newspapers, that they are, we are going for elections.
How about your chairman?
I would love to correct that.
Let's come back to him. Let's give him an opportunity to finish, then you come back. For me, I say
we cannot put the cart before the horse. From now up to January, up to February, is enough time. There is still space for us to implement some of the provisions that have not yet been implemented. That is one. Number two, it is not us here who will be deciding the fate of the agreement and as to whether people will go for elections or not. It is the principals who are signatory to the agreement that will sit.
You're talking of the five vice presidents?
The five vice presidents are not signatories, are not the only signatories to the agreement. And they are not signatories to the agreement. But principals, the parties who are signatory, the SPLM in government, the IO, the OPP,
SOA,
and FDs, these are the signatories to the agreement. These are the people who will sit and decide based on the evaluation that they will get. Each and every party is, I presume, is at present making its own evaluation and everything, so that when time comes, they will be in a position to sit and decide. So I cannot talk at this time as to whether there will be elections or not.
Stephen Parr, you have something burning. Yeah, I want to close with that so that we can move forward.
I agree with Honorable Michael that he can speak for his party. But it's wrong for him to speak for my party. The position, the political position of the SPLM, IO now, and that is what our chairman, Dr. Riek Machar, said last Saturday. And this need to come very clearly. We are not afraid of election as a party. We are just saying that the conditions for elections are not there. And the conditions set for elections in the agreements are very clear. They are actually the major stipulation of the agreement. Should the major stipulations of the agreement, such as census, constitutional making process, and other political arrangements happen to be in place like Honorable Makuei is now predicting, I hope his predictions are correct. If his prediction come true, the SPLM-SPLA-IO will be ready to go for election.
Let's end it on that high note that you, the SPLM-IO, will be ready when the conditions are conducive. Thank you very much, distinguished guests, and my sister here for turning up for this fruitful and peaceful discussion. I must say this was a nice South Sudan dialogue that ended up peacefully.
My colleague John Tanzer there speaking to political leaders and analysts about South Sudan's road to democracy. On the other side of the break, we hit the streets of Juba and ask the people of South Sudan what they want for the future of their country. We'll be right back.
Like here in Yabio, we can be able to proceed to Juba and even in some parts of the southern Sudan. We need the roads to be good and security also to be good so that we can be free.
We have really deviated from the originality of our identity as South Sudanese, but I would really appeal that we forget about all those ethnic lines and return back to our social cohesion. It was one of the best that all over, I think, Africa, there wasn't any social cohesion and solidarity that people would really stand for each other like before.
We cannot wait for somebody to bring us the peace, not the African Union, not the international community, not the Rome Initiative. Those are just assistance, but they cannot bring us peace. We are the only people that can bring our own peace to South Sudan.
Three quarters of us, some of their room members is in diaspora, in the neighboring countries, in refugee camp, they're not in their village, they're not in other places. This is concern. It's something that's gonna concern all of us. Like we feel like something is wrong. Because if my family members is not in their right place, how do you want me to call that as a peace in the country?
If there's no war, we need the government to provide a proper road network to connect the state with the states, with the Tarmac Road, with the Maram Roads and so on. So what we see now from Juba to Bo, which is great, that is great. If it also happens to Western Equatoria, from Western Equatoria it links to Bahara Ghazal, from Bahara Ghazal again to... So that means now the network, the road network will be everywhere and the commodity will be at every corner and the poverty will not also be there.
And that wraps up our special edition of Straight Talk Africa. Thank you to our hardworking team in Juba, John Tanzer, Karina Chowdhury, and Andrew Wani. Thank you to all of our affiliate stations for airing this show across the African continent. And of course, as always, a big thank you to you, our audience, for joining us on television, radio, and online. Thank you for always watching and always listening. From our teams in Washington and South Sudan, do take care. We'll see you next time. Go well. Goodbye.